Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lincoln on Lending, David Lincoln.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Lincoln on Lending. It's a mortgage program for the mortgage industry, created by mortgage professionals for mortgage professionals, and we appreciate you listening in each and every week. Today is July 11th. We took a break for the holidays. We didn't have a program July 4th. We trust that each of you had a great 4th of July. It's good to have you back with us and joining our growing audience across the country. And boy, it is growing. I'm getting so much feedback as I go around and speak around the country. So good to have so many of you walk up and tell us how much you enjoy the program. This week, we're going to continue on what's going to be a fairly lengthy series about the future of mortgage banking. And we're going to be focusing later in the program on the future of the secondary markets and specifically what kind of products are we going to have in a post Fannie Freddie era. Should they go away, most likely they are, what is it going to look like? What are the secondary markets? Are we going to have a 30-year mortgage? That's the big, big question. We're going to get into it. We have a special guest with us, and we'll be on later in the program, Dr. Michael Lee, who's the director of Corky McMillan Center for Real Estate in San Diego State University. Great guest. I've had the privilege of speaking on the podium or be on the same venue with Michael. You are going to find his commentary very insightful. You're not going to want to miss the program. Stay tuned all the way to the end. But as we do each and every week, let's get started off with what's going on in the world of interest rates. Joe Farr, good to have you back. I hope you had a good 4th of July, Joe.
Had a great 4th of July, and you?
Yeah, good, good. What's up with rates today?
Well, rates are down. That's what's up. Rates are down. Mortgage MBS prices are up. We've had 2 days in a row now where we've seen a fairly substantial improvement in mortgage-backed security prices. Today, MBS prices are about 10, 30 seconds better than where they ended Friday. And if it's not one country, it's another, isn't it? Where it was Greece and Ireland, and now Italy's making headlines. This morning, the focus seemed to shift from Greece onto Italy and its ability to honor its debt obligations, and as a result, MBS prices have improved with a little flight to safety, and stocks, as you might imagine, are a good bit lower. They're down about 150 points on the Dow. So, they're just having trouble over there, and we've got to get through several issues in Portugal and Ireland and Italy and Greece and Spain. So.
Gosh, there's a lot of countries over there and more to come. I know Michael's going to be able to give us, our guest later in the program, is going to give us some insights into some of that as he is well-known in Europe and speaking across the country. Let's talk about what happened last week. It was another one of those crazy weeks for a short week. It was crazy.
Yeah, let's go back 2 weeks since we didn't have a show on the 4th. The week of the 27th, we lost. MBS prices fell every day that week. There was a growing sentiment that the economic measures were strong and stronger than expected. Generally, outlooks were positive for a buildup in the pace of growth, and as a result, MBS prices suffered. Mortgage rates rose between Monday the 27th and the Thursday before the jobs report last week, we saw about a 1% drop in MBS prices, and that equated to somewhere around 20-25 basis points in mortgage rates, which is a big move. But then on Friday, the jobs report came out woefully below expectations, and as a result of that, the movement Friday and today has just about reversed all of that 1% drop in prices that led up to Friday's jobs report. And with that jobs report, it was reported 18,000 jobs created when, just on Thursday before, the expectations were raised to reflect 120,000 jobs. a big miss, a big surprise, and quite frankly, it's kind of changed the sentiment. People are now not talking about the picking up the pace of economic growth. They're wondering if growth can happen without jobs coming along. So it's a real different outlook just based on that one report.
Isn't that amazing? Imagine, can we pick up the pace without job growth? Job growth just seems so key. But that's just my comments on that. But anyway, what's on the news as far as the economy, just overall? Is it focusing more on oil prices and the likes of that?
This week it's got so much to look at, it's hard to focus on any one thing. We've got, think about what's coming out this week, Dave. We got Treasury auctions, the 10 and the 30-year in particular. First auctions of those securities since QE2's ended. So, the question is, will there be demand? And if so, at what yields? We've got some critical economic measures coming out, both for growth perspectives. The retail sales comes out on Thursday and industrial production comes out on Friday. How strong are those going to be? And if they're strong, will they be ignored, kind of just like the weak reports from the weeks past? We're being ignored. So, has this jobs report that came out on Friday turned that sentiment? Then the second quarter earnings will begin to be announced. The first of the earnings reports begins tonight, and it'll be a big week for earnings. And so those economic measures will be big. And then inflation measures comes out next week. Now, I'm sorry, this week. PPI on Thursday and CPI on Friday, and I don't think anyone's expecting these to reflect rising inflations to the point of concern for mortgage rates, but who knows? The market's just so sensitive to every little measure going on now. And then the last, but maybe most significant, actually I don't think it will be, but everyone expects the debt limit to be increased, and the debate will continue this week. You heard the president this morning talking about the politics around that and the need to come together and compromise. So we'll see how all that unravels. But, we've got a few weeks left before the debt ceiling's limits reached, and so the peak of this discussion is probably not going to be this week, but certainly it's going to receive a lot of attention. So just a lot of things going on right now, some of them economic. Yeah, but a lot of it's just going to be driven by sentiment. What do these various things do to impact the sentiment of the investor?
And then, we got enough economic data coming out of the U.S., and then you look over at Europe, and, what does this all mean? And then you read the headlines. One of the headlines that captured my attention this morning is when China was saying that we ought to back off on our defense spending. That was a tongue-in-cheek. Are you kidding me?
Amazing.
I check all that. I go, but when we owe so much money to them, it's amazing that they would stand up and start making comment about our defense spending. That was kind of over the top.
Are they making those comments as a creditor or as a competitor?
I would check all of the above would be the category I'd check. Joe, thank you so much, as you do each and every week. MBS Quote Line is such a valuable service for us in the industry. We appreciate it so much. Stay tuned, everybody. We're going to have on the Hot Topic segment Dr. Michael Lee, talking about the future of the mortgage industry as it relates to the secondary markets and specifically the 30-year fixed mortgage. You're not going to want to miss this topic. We'll be right back after this brief word.
Economic uncertainty has created a tremendous amount of market volatility for the past few weeks. Intraday price changes seem the rule rather than the exception. Have you been surprised by a midday price change? Have you been frustrated as you locked a loan just ahead of a price movement? Found it difficult to explain to a customer why the rate you quoted is no longer available? MBS Quoteline can eliminate these frustrations. MBS Quoteline monitors Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae mortgage-backed security prices in real time. It makes the information conveniently available on your desktop, smartphone, or by email or text message. These are the same prices used to set mortgage rates each morning and to issue midday price changes when significant movement occurs. With MBS Quoteline, you'll never be out of touch with the market, whether you're in the office or on the road. See for yourself what MBS Quoteline can do for you. Go to mbsquoteline.com to start a risk-free two-week trial. mbsquoteline.com. 646-716-4972. The Lincoln on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lincoln.
Good to be back with you again this week. It is July 11th. Did I mention that earlier? I don't know that I did, but it's July 11th. We mentioned that at each segment, just so for those of you that are downloading and listening to this, know many of you download and listen to this program for many reasons, but many of you, it's for specifically Alice's information. Alice Alvey, President of Mortgage U, is with us again to give us a legislative update. Nothing more happening than the legislative calendar. Alice, good to have you with us. And what'd you do for your 4th of July? Do you have a good 4th?
Oh, Dave, I did. We had great weather here in Michigan, as you had in Minnesota. We had a wonderful time up here in our beautiful state. So, anyway, I had a great weekend. You know, tried to forget about the legislation, but it's really hard when it's looming over your head.
Looming.
At least they're focused very much on the budget right now and the debt issues. But so today, the NBA Newslink is reporting that the House Financial Services Committee is supposed to be looking at this set of Fannie Freddie bills. I don't know if you all remember, but we've had two different shows where we talked about the groups of bills about Fannie and Freddie. All total, I'm counting about 16 of them. It depends who counts what where on what day. And they range from, you know, trying to attack every aspect of the GSEs today as they're sitting in conservatorship and trying to come up with laws that will control their activities right now, as well as coming up with what is the future of Fannie and Freddie. Because some are very concerned that they're not really locked down tight enough by law.
Right.
And so the rules get into that they must be subject to the same risk retention rules as the Dodd-Frank Act. They definitely have a bill out there to try and suspend executive compensation, which, you know, certainly a popular thing in the general public's eyes without them kind of realizing what the consequences to that are. They want Fannie and Freddie's affordable housing goals to be repealed. There's another bill about increasing the fees, another bill about capping their portfolio and actually planning out legislatively what would be the wind down of how much they can hold in mortgages, keeping that the cap right now would be at $700 billion in the first year, declining to $600 then 475 and 350. So each year getting down to those numbers until trying to look out at 5 years from now that they're only a $250 billion portfolio. That's a dramatic shift from how important they've been in the market. Yeah, you know, and so as you kind of keep looking through the list of things, it would be just really trying to attack all aspects of them, making them dispose of non-mission critical assets, cap the amount of bailout funds. One of them is a bill to ensure, they want to say in writing, ensure that the quasi-government replica is not created. So part of Congress's, if you want to recreate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, then recreate them. Don't just, you know, make something that we already had and just give it a different name. So I know we've had other shows, we've talked in detail about that, but I wanted to let everybody know we'll continue to watch what the legislative front is for Fannie and Freddie, not only their future, but their current standings now. Also on the docket, we did have that we had H.R. 940. We announced two shows ago that's the covered bond legislation, which we'll find out more about when we get to talk to Dr. Michael Lee later in the program. The House Financial Services Committee did pass the covered bonds bill, so that's just getting it out of committee so that it can be discussed on the floor. So this was June 23rd, I believe, is the date that passed. So it's H.R. 940. If you're interested in covered bonds, you can read about this, and like I said, we'll talk more about it. I'm sure on everyone's mind, too, is our QRM. You know, Dave, we've talked a little bit about risk retention. I know your customers are concerned about risk retention. Have they been commenting? Have you been talking to your customers about commenting?
Every time. It's like, you know, good morning, good to talk to you. Have you commented on QRM? Get your voice heard. Have we had any feedback? Give us an update.
Yeah, you know, what's working well is the idea that we have both consumer groups and lenders together on this, that we've got to make sure there's not a down payment restriction within the definition of qualified residential mortgage. All of you have the ability to respond. Go to send an email at regs.comments@federalreserve.gov and tell them that you're commenting.
Repeat that one more time, Alice, just so we have extra. Because people write it down. They go, man, tell her to repeat those websites.
Right. The email address is regs.comments@federalreserve.gov. That's just one of many ways you can respond. You can also just use your search feature and, you know, actually now there's so many hits on it. You go qualified residential mortgage, you know, respond to proposed rule, and I'll bet you get a hit to where you can just hit click and go forward with it. But you do want to make sure your voice is heard about the impact to consumers, especially those of you who have your own local community data that would give some insight into this is overstepping what the regulators had in mind at the time. I'm sorry, the legislator, the Congress had in mind at the time they crafted QRM. No one wanted to eliminate or set up down payment requirements that would take middle America out of this equation. It was, let's just stop doing option mortgages for people who can't qualify option ARMs. So anyway, I believe we have a framework already out there by the definition of non-traditional mortgages. Let's just use that.
Right.
So yep. So we have till August 1st on that one. And I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
No, good. No.
Oh, okay.
Keep rolling.
And then we have until July 21st, you know, this month, actually by next week's show, we'll be watching to see this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau get in place. You have till July 21st to comment on qualified mortgages and issues related to that. That is such an important definition as well. We don't want it so restrictive that they start telling us what qualifying ratios are in federal legislation. That's an overlay we don't need. So, and we're also going to continue to watch HUD requesting comments on it, improve their regulatory and regulation review. We're going to be watching HUD's involvement in the legislative process as well as they're trying to see how they can do better on what regulations need to be expanded or repealed. Dave, last but not least, I'm still crossing my fingers on that House bill. Oh, that terrible. It just left my House bill, like, in the very beginning of the year, 30-something, that says repeal Dodd-Frank. It's just a one-liner.
Yes.
I'm still holding out hope for that one.
We can hold out hope.
So that's the legislative update for today.
Good. Holding out, still holding out for a repeal.
Right.
Like that. Can you imagine that one bill moving through? A one-line bill that's being proposed versus the 23,000 pages of something,
right.
Or how many thousands of pages? That's wild. That's funny. Alice, thank you so much for bringing us an update. Can't wait to get into discussion with Dr. Lee about H.R. 940, the Covered Bond Act, get some feedback. And generally just speaking, his whole perspective is going to be so valuable. I've spent hours talking to Dr. Michael Lee on this topic. You're going to find this very, very interesting, listeners. You're not going to want to miss this topic. Stay tuned. And we've got the Profit Doctor coming up. He's always got an interesting twist and a way to relate that. You're going to want to miss that. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals providing classroom and web-based delivery and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees both live and online on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lickin' on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's David Lickin'.
Welcome back, everybody. We're so excited to hear from all of you. We appreciate your comments. A lot of comment about the Profit Doctor segment. Love to hear what the Profit Doctor has to say. Andy Schell, also known as a Profit Doctor, welcome back from the 4th of July. Did you have a good 4th of July break, Andy?
Well, you did. You know, I celebrated the 4th of July just like they do in England. Do they have a 4th of July in England, by the way?
it's a calendar date, but I'm not sure it's a holiday. Other than they got rid of, like Alice said, Alice, whose mother's English says, yeah, they got rid of the colonies is how they celebrated.
Yeah, they celebrate getting rid of us. That's what my mom says in English.
Well, you know, it's hot in Austin, and without a pool, then what do you do outside? Well, you don't necessarily. And so, no, I had a good 4th. I'm just kidding. It was fun time for all.
Well, that's amazing.
Getting into the Profit Doctor segment, because as I watched the clock tick, I better be focused here, because I know we want to hear what Dr. Lee has to say.
Yes.
And as you know, Dave, we're working with a number of large investment groups, and these investment groups are looking to have us help them acquire or create a $1 billion mortgage bank. I mean, they want to get in, and they want to get in a big way, and they want to get in quickly. And in talking with them and in some of the work that we've been doing over the years in acquisition support, it raises the question, what are the characteristics of a successful billion-dollar company? You know, what's the top 10 list of the successful billion-dollar company? And you know, as you know too, Dave, many of our clients are billion-dollar companies. They're doing $1, $2, $3, $4 billion in mortgage volume a year. And so we know them well, and we help them on a lot of different fronts. And so we can identify the key elements that are consistent among them. And what's interesting is that they all have unique characteristics, all have elements that are unique to them, but they also all share a number of common elements that really, in my opinion, form the basis, kind of creates the list, the basis for success of a billion-dollar mortgage bank. So here you go.
Let's get into it. I can't wait to hear your list. All right.
Yeah. So here are the top 10
lists. Is this like the David Letterman, the top 10 list or something?
Yes, exactly. Except I'll do it backwards, but nevertheless, yes. So number
all right.
10. Okay, leadership. The leadership of a company, it has to be experienced and professional and dynamic and competent and inspiring. And the leadership of the company has to be great at communicating and possesses, really, Dave, all of the key leadership characteristics that you've been talking about in the articles
right.
you've been writing every month. What other? There's like seven key.
The seven keys, the seven C's of leadership is what I'm writing about. You can find that in National Mortgage Professional Magazine for those of you that want to read that. We're getting a lot of good fun. Yeah, leadership is key.
You have to have really solid leadership, and it's also communication because it's how you communicate, because when you're in a billion-dollar company with hundreds if not thousands of people, you can't have FaceTime with everybody. You can't go around and have one-on-one. So the ability to communicate to a group and be able to communicate effectively, and so really in this first point, communication is essential, and it's effectively casting a vision. And Dave, I know you're great at doing this. It's effectively casting a vision that is understood and embraced by the team. You have to be able to do that to be able to get to a billion.
And what's interesting, you bring up the word communication, because that's the next C that I'm writing. In fact, I've got to send that article off later today to the editor, Eric Peck, there at National Mortgage Professionals. So for those of you that want to read about what my thoughts are in communication, you should do that. And I've learned a lot from Andy Schell on his ability to communicate. All right, so that's number one.
Well, the next one, you have to have solid and robust operational and financial infrastructure. And this
one of your favorite topics.
Sorry?
One of your favorite topics, operations and financial infrastructure.
It is. It really is. I confess, most people's eyes roll back in the back of their head and they think it's incredibly boring, but companies are not successful without this. And so you have to have this operational and financial infrastructure that produces extensive operational financial metrics. And why do we have to have metrics? Well, we have to have metrics that capture really every aspect of the activity of the company, and then measure those results against an objective standard. Because if you shoot at nothing, you'll hit it every time. So you've got to have the ability to capture information and all the financial data out of every single loan and every transaction within the company, and then be able to produce profitability reports for every loan officer, every loan, every branch, every segment of the company, secondary marketing, operations. You have to be able to capture the operational details, the how many people, how much time. And then what's really interesting is that their ability, these billion-dollar companies that we work with, their ability to access financial and operational details is amazing. I mean, they can get access to anything, and they can measure ROI on every activity. We've worked with some smaller companies where we ask them for information, and it takes them 3 weeks to get it. We call these big companies where you would think it's so unwieldy, and so they're so big and so many moving parts. But they can get information in a matter of minutes because they have that strong of a system that's in place, and you have to have that. And that really leads to the next point. You have to have a technology platform that provides seamless and accurate data transfer from the front end at origination all the way through servicing. You've got to be able to have access to all the information in a flow that makes sense and works. A lot of times folks go with technology where you have the tail wagging the dog, and really you've got to get a technology that fits your process flow. And you have to have systems that are designed well to meet the workflow needs of the business, while at the same time, there's that word again, ROI. You've got to have a technology infrastructure that meets the workflow needs and at the same time meets the ROI expectation, because, you know, you just can't buy every new cool technology. The technology that you have has to make the business better.
And a chaser of cool technology I have been, and have fallen on that sword a couple of times, yes.
Now, the next point, number six, is that this kind of comes right back to some of Alice's stuff. You have to have documented procedures and a training mechanism, and the ability and the method to make certain the staff is understanding and communicating all this information, and then confirming that the staff is performance is accurate based on the training and the procedures. You know, you've got to do it right the first time, every time. So you've got to be able to measure everything and identify when the staff is not performing as expected, and then when you find someone who's not performing, you help them get better. You know, a lot of these companies have online customized training. They get staff up to speed very quickly, and then they measure. And it's not just do it once. It's do it consistently and every week, every month, on and on and on. And a lot of these companies also will use companies to come in and do workflow enhancement studies, bringing best practices from other companies to help them be the best they can possibly be. You know, it's one of those, you wonder why this is even on the list, but you've got to have procedures and you've got to have training, because procedures without training is going to disconnect. You've got to know what needs to be done and then make sure it gets done correctly the first time, every time. And a lot of mid-sized companies fail at this miserably, but to be a billion-dollar successful profitable company, you have to do this.
And you might as well start learning how to do it when you're small, because if you do it, like you say, the big companies are doing it and can turn out the data very, very quickly.
Yeah, and they train their staff over and over and over.
Training,
and number five,
the key is training. Yes. Okay. Number five.
They have a well-balanced and well-documented future incentive program. Well, you may think, well, okay, now what now? You know, a company that measures and shares their success with their staff is a company that is on the path to future success. The company has to be able to effectively get the key players in the company, and I'm not talking just production, I'm talking all the way through the organization. You've got to get people bought in and engaged with the future success of the company by providing an incentive program, a bonus program back to everybody in the company. I know we've got the issues on LO comp and all that, but we've got to be able to incent people so that their future benefit is directly tied to their activity. And then make it so that it's structured so they know what triggers the bonus programs. It's really important that the companies all do that. The next point, number four, and this one may seem a
number
little
six.
Bit hard.
Is this number six, or are you doing it counting backwards?
Yeah, counting down to number one. The number one reason.
All right, good. Number four.
Make sure we're all on the same page. I know I wrote it backwards. I'm saying it backwards. Transcribing it in my head, Dave. Number four, middle managers of a company, and this may seem harsh, but the middle managers of a company have to be the top tier of their peers. They have to be among the best, if not the best, in the industry for what they do. And you have to hire and keep the best. And this is the part that gets a little dicey. If someone is not the best, then they really need to get someone that is. And it may seem cruel, but especially if someone grew up in an organization, if you had an organization that was doing $10 million a month, and then you got to $50 million a month, then $100 million a month, it's very likely some of the people that were there doing important jobs at $10 million a month do not have the ability and the skill set to do the job at $100 million.
Yep.
Growing organizations means there's going to be changing positions. People's complexity is going to be different. A big company is not just a little company that's a lot bigger. The infrastructure and the management and the strategy and the techniques are different. And we see this occasionally. We call it the Peter principle. It's when people rise to their level of incompetence. And that's bad for everybody because they're basically being set up to fail, and that's not good for anyone. So the key is to hire the best, and during times of growth, be able to support the organization, and if someone isn't able to take to the next step, find a place for them, and then hire the best you can find to take the company to the next level, because it really comes down to the people. You can't just do it yourself. You've got to have intermediate management that are very, very good at what they do and buy into the future. Okay, we're almost done. We're almost done. Just a few more to go. So the next
number
one
three.
Is The next one is what's actually the next point is The next point is we've got to have an effective recruiting process, a stable and effective production recruiting process.
Yeah.
And the key point is it has to attract and retain top branches that produce profitable results, not necessarily high volume. This is the thing that everybody gets wrong. It's not the highest volume branch. You want the most profitable branch.
Profitable, yes.
That's
the focus that's
hard
over. So many executives struggle with that one, Andy. I just want volume and focus on volume. No, it's profitable volume.
Yep. So it's profitable volume, and it starts by knowing low-level profitability and then knowing how to help branches get more money and then getting the branches so they see the vision for the company as a whole and not just what's good for their branch. That is one of the most important points. Branches that you bring on that are only and all about them are going to fail as a part of the organization. There has to be a buy-in. There has to be a culture that's embraced by all of the new offices, and you do that through training and the incentive programs and the ownership and the parent. There's a lot of different ways to do it, but the branches have to be more than just all about them. And it's challenging. It's difficult to do that, but you want to get long-term, stable, profitable branches that may not be the highest volume branches. Because they always, sometimes really big volume branches are giving away pricing, and that doesn't necessarily help anybody. A couple of other quick points as we wrap this thing up. Extensive financial and cash flow forecasting. These companies have the ability to anticipate how much money they're going to need in 3 months or 6 months based on all kinds of different changes in the environment. You know, nobody can predict the future. We can't predict the future. So what companies do is they run a model of permutations. They go, well, if rates do this or investor purchases slow down or if this happens or that happens, what are we going to do? And then they come up with strategies to address all of those potential changes. And a lot of folks that we see that are smaller or mid-sized companies don't even have a financial forecast. I mean, they're so far from being able to have the tools to be able to be a billion-dollar company that it's not just having the tools, it's using the tools and using them regularly in order to predict outcomes and come up with solutions to the various outcomes that happen based on changes in volume and changes in the market, changes in pricing. You got to predict all these things and see what happens. The next point, and we're almost wrapping up now, the next point is they have to have deep relationships with third-party support, with appraisal management, with your technology vendor, with your whether it's pricing or operations or whatever your technology is, your fraud control, your emails groups, your advisory firms like us that come in, the folks buying your loans, the investors or your securitization partners with agencies and GSEs, and if you're forward selling TBAs, the trading firms. You know, this is one of the quotes from Hillary Clinton's book from way back about it takes a village. Well, it takes a village to operate a mortgage bank. It's more than just the management team. It's all the other companies that come together surrounding that company to help them drive success. And this is the important point about vendor management. It's got to be a win-win structure where everybody is in it for each other and both come out with success better than they would be with it being ROI-based. Vendor management, vendor support, really, really important. So now, I kind of lost count, but the number one reason,
this drum roll, is so important.
The number one point is cash is king. So that means for a mortgage bank, it's warehouse funding. It's the lifeblood of the mortgage bank. Warehouse lines can make or break a company. The billion-dollar companies can get just about any funding they want because they have extensive relationships with virtually all the top-tier warehouse line lenders in the country, and they make certain that those warehouse line lenders understand their business. They're giving these warehouse line lenders accurate financial reports on a timely basis, great metrics, explanations of the results. So these warehouse lenders are confident that their loans are going to get purchased, that the results are going to be positive, that they've anticipated the future things that can go wrong. They've anticipated all the things that go boom in the night. So these warehouse line lenders want to give them more money because there's such a high confidence that they're run well. It's a great operation that they can get money for servicing. They can get money for just about anything they need. The warehouse land lenders are falling over themselves trying to get these guys to borrow more money, and they do that because they did all the other lists. They did the rest of the list perfectly, and they get to the end of the day, and they can get as much money as they need. And they change their business, and they're dynamic, and they understand what it takes to be profitable over and over and over. So as I wrap this up now, Dave, I'm going a little bit longer than I expected. The thing we got to remember is that these companies were not always as they are today. You know, today they're stable and efficient and effective and ROI-driven and service-oriented, and they have dependable profitability. And because they are there now, all the vendors want to do business with them, and all the warehouse landlords want to do business with them, and all the branches want to go work for them. But they weren't always like that. They grew into that, and they grew into that by looking at this list and pursuing the list over and over and over. They started somewhere, and they ended here because they knew where they were going, and they had direction to get there. Now, it takes time. So if you're building a company, just remember you got to keep focusing and keep moving forward, and two strikes means you're just one hit away from a home run.
That's a great point. I like my favorite quote I'm going to walk away from: when there's no target, when you're not shooting at a target, you'll hit it every time. What was that quote that you said, that phrase?
Well, if you shoot at nothing, you'll hit it every time.
Yeah, when you shoot at nothing, you'll hit it every time. Folks, you got to have something to hit at. Great points, Prophet Doctor. Appreciate it very much. Folks, we're going to have Michael Lee talking. Good to have you, Andy, with us all the time. For the sake of time, let's move on. We're going to get on after a brief break. We're going to get on with Dr. Michael Lee. So excited to talk about the future of the secondary markets and the 30-year mortgage. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
PMI Mortgage Insurance Company is the clear choice for your higher LTV conventional borrowers. Unlike FHA, PMI offers a choice of flexible premium plans to fit the individual needs of each borrower, from a one-time upfront cost with no renewal premium to a monthly plan with no upfront charges. PMI's premium plans recognize larger down payment and good credit history, saving your clients what can at times be thousands of dollars. PMI also provides lenders with fast electronic submission tools to increase efficiencies. Mortgage insurance is more relevant than ever, so it's important to utilize a mortgage insurer who's committed to the business for the long term. It is vital that you work with a company whose core competency is credit risk management and bring that wealth of knowledge to your firm. At PMI, mortgage insurance is their only business, so they have to get it right. PMI's mission is to create sustainable homeownership opportunities. To learn more about how PMI solutions can assist your business, please contact your PMI representative today or call 800-966-4PMI, 800-966-4PMI. In today's climate, quality counts more than ever, and Wetzel's Trot can help your company maintain the quality that you require to survive in an ever-changing market. With over 450 customers across the country, Wetzel's Trot has specialized in quality control reviews for residential lenders since 1985. Wetzel's Trot can assist your organization in maintaining a high standard of quality within your residential mortgage operation. They offer a wide variety of services, including loan quality control, servicing quality control, quality control plans, fraud review services, and even web-based quality control software. Quality is never an accident. It is always the result of high intention, sincere effort, intelligent direction, and skillful execution. Choosing Wetzel's Trot represents the wise choice of many alternatives. Contact Wetzel's Trot today for details at 248-592-2252. Wetzel's Trot, the single source solution for your quality control needs. And now, broadcasting live from Austin, Texas, we're back with the Lickin' on Lending Show.
Good to have you back, everybody. Again, we're excited to be talking about, as we have been for the last few weeks, the future of mortgage banking. And there's nothing more question up in the air than we talk about the GSEs, specifically Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What is the future of the secondary markets and the products we're going to have? We're fortunate today to have Dr. Michael Lee, and that's spelled L-E-A, if you want to Google his name. He's director of the Corky McMillan Center for Real Estate at San Diego State University. He works in the capacity of being responsible for fostering real estate education, industry outreach, and research. Love the research he does. He's also a visiting professor of finance. He has over 25 years of financial service industry expertise, 20 years of international advisory work. That's where I met him, is over at Madrid, speaking at the Eurocatalyst event a number of years ago. He has been worked in 30 countries spanning six continents. Folks, welcome to the program with me. Long bio here. I love to read it all. Very impressive. But best of all, Michael, it's just good to hear your voice again and be together with you on this program.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be on the program, and it's always a pleasure to speak with you, David.
Oh, I appreciate it so much, Michael. And we're talking about the secondary markets, the future of the secondary markets. And I think the big question in everyone's mind is, it really boils down to this: Are we going to have a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage after all is said and done?
We will, but there'll be far less of a market share than the current 90% plus that they have. They'll be somewhat more expensive, and I think that we're going to see alternatives come up due to that, that we don't necessarily have to lock interest rates for 30 years to provide payment protection for borrowers. And we can do that, I think, cheaper if we have things like rollover mortgages that they have in Canada and Europe that lock rates for 5 to 10 years and share some of that interest rate risk between investors and borrowers.
So true. So so there is a future for the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, but your thought is that it's going to be a bit higher. Joe, let's get you in on this dialogue. I know you have a lot of listeners very interested in some of your questions, getting answers to some of your questions.
Well, the first one I start from with is that I am a big fan of mortgage-backed securities because of the efficiency and the consistency that has evolved with that. And Dr. Lee, can you give me some assurance that the mortgage-backed security is going to survive as a structure?
I think it will survive as a structure, though it clearly needs to have some retooling and change. I'm speaking now of the private label market. If you look around the world, there are many countries that have securitized mortgages without government guarantees. And, you know, that I think can be the case here. But we need to, first of all, get some regulatory certainty with regard to what the rules of the road are going to be, things like risk retention, you know, capital adequacy, et cetera. But then we have to work on creating simpler, more standardized instruments that, you know, we can get the kind of volume that you're looking for. And I think we can do that without government guarantees.
As you were mentioning those things that need to change, one of the things that's coming up lately is all these things that seem to ignore the contract between the consumer and the creditor, like the foreclosure avoidance things and the principal reductions and you know, now with the QM definition where people can walk away from or the foreclosure can be permanently avoided. Do those kinds of things throw a wrench in the works here in that, if the contract isn't going to be enforceable, you get into all kinds of counterparty risk?
Absolutely. One of the reasons we've had a successful mortgage market up till now is the fact that we have strong laws that underlie creditor rights with regard to mortgage contracts. And you can simply look around the world and see that those countries that have strong laws like this have much more successful, much deeper mortgage markets with more flexible lending terms and lower rates. And if you don't have that kind of protection, then you have less mortgage lending and higher cost.
Well, and lower rates is a key element there. If the government guarantee, or should I say when the government guarantee goes away, let's say if the government guarantee goes away, do you have a sense of its impact on pricing? Do you think there'll be a substantial increase in price, or will the government begin to more appropriately price the risk for themselves?
Well, you know, there's kind of two parts to an answer to that question. I think that if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were appropriately capitalized to start with and didn't have the great leverage they had, then mortgage rates would have been more expensive in the past, and any future that includes Fannie and Freddie should have much more capital buffers for them. The second part is, yes, without a government guarantee, mortgage rates will rise, but I don't think that rise is going to be that large. If you go back pre-crisis, you saw that the jumbo market, the jumbo prime market, was 30 basis points or so higher, and I think that if we can get back to well underwritten mortgages in significant volume, we can see spreads really come down from where they currently are. So yes, somewhat more expensive, but not to the point where you're going to seriously undermine the mortgage market.
Well, Alice, we were talking a little bit earlier about H.R. 940. Why don't you get into some of the topics and related, the discussion related to that?
Well, hi, Dr. Leah. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
As you know, I cover the legislative update, and we have H.R. 940. So on the covered bonds topic, I'm interested in your opinion of that legislation, if you've had a chance to review it, or if not, what in your mind needs to be done legislative-wise to have the right framework for covered bonds to work, market acceptance maybe aside, or maybe the bill does have to try and encourage market acceptance. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I haven't looked at the latest version of the covered bond legislation, but first and foremost, I think it's important to have a strong legislative framework. If you look across the world, those countries that have successful covered bond markets really do depend on having that strong framework. Secondly, I think if you also look around the world at two kind of pieces of information that's embedded in legislative frameworks, you'll see something a little different than what I've seen in past legislative attempts here, which is to have a focused approach where you define the acceptable amounts of collateral and you don't throw everything, including the kitchen sink, into it. And so I think that strong law really has to focus on mortgages and specify the characteristics of mortgages that would be acceptable collateral. But beyond that, I think there are several other issues that really have to be addressed. Obviously, the FDIC's concern needs to be taken into account. And the question there is, what would be a reasonable proportion of assets or liabilities that a bank can fund with covered bonds, because the whole essence of that is you take those assets away from FDIC deposit insurance in the event of a failure of the institution. But I think the 4% limit now is too restrictive.
Well, and to your point, when you look at the bill, the one that has gone through the committee, it's exactly what you're saying. It doesn't have exactly what you say it does need. It really is just throwing the whole thing up into the air to just say, let's have a regulator identify those types of specifics, such as, because it doesn't have a residential focus. It's trying to cover assets, other asset securities, and mm-hmm. it doesn't give amounts like you mentioned. It just tries to set a framework for what if a particular entity ends up in default, and how is that side of it managed? So
right, but from a standpoint of investors and the rating agencies, they're not going to like that approach, because regulators can change their minds. And the whole idea behind having a strong legislative framework is you lock things in place. And so that's, I think, a weakness of the U.S. approach at this point. But there are a couple other issues I'd like to just mention with regard to covered bonds that have gotten a bit less scrutiny, I think. First of all is the kind of role of the Federal Home Loan Banks in this country, because effectively the home loan bank model is a competitor for the covered bonds. And that gives rise in part to the FDIC's concern, because the collateral behind Federal Home Loan Bank advances also gets taken off the balance sheet in the event of institution insolvency. So getting that kind of worked out is, I think, important. But the other thing is the kind of securities that are likely to be issued under a covered bond legislation. If you look around the world, covered bonds have popularity with investors because they're very simple, they're very standardized, and they're, as a consequence, pretty liquid in terms of their volume and trading. But they're all bullet bond type structures, meaning that they don't have the prepayment type of cash flow risk that
right.
is part of our mortgage securities. Now, the way that they accomplish that, if you have fixed rate mortgages, is to allow prepayment penalties. And this gets back to an earlier topic in this show, QRM. And QRM, if you look at the specifics there, really puts a damper on the use of prepayment penalties. And so I think that's going to, even if we got reasonable legislation passed, dealing with that issue is important to the future of covered bonds.
One of the things, when we got together here in Austin, I think it's almost been a year ago now, Michael, we were talking about what you're seeing in Europe and some other things. Can you comment on some of the recent developments? What is it that, if it's not going to be covered bonds or some variation of that, what do you see as a potential for what's coming? You speak at numerous you give presentations all over the academia world, professional, and you're testifying to Congress. What are you telling people that you think is the best vehicle for the future as it relates to the securitization markets?
Well, I think
or the whole mortgage
from
model,
overall
mortgage
funding
model.
Of mortgages has to be better balanced than what we see in the U.S. I don't think that it's a sustainable model to have 90% of your mortgages having to be securitized and backed by a government guarantee. So if you look around the world, you find that we're really unusual. We're unusual with regard to the proportion of lending that we fund through the securitization markets, and that's, I think, due to the effect of Fannie and Freddie and, you know, the effect that they have on pricing. And then the second part of it is this fixed-rate mortgage. You don't see other countries have a dominance of this long-term fixed-rate mortgage. They, both in terms of the kind of products that are available as well as the funding sources, tend to be a lot more balanced, you know, combination of deposit funding, covered bonds, and securitization, along with a combination of short and kind of adjustable rate mortgages as well as medium and longer term fixed rates.
Well, I want to get you definitely. Someone started asking a question real quick. We're running out of time here. I want to get. Was there one other question out there, Alice, Joe, Andy?
I was just going to jump in and say, but we're hooked on a 30-year mortgage. So go ahead with your question, Andy. I mean, we're as a country hooked on a 30-year mortgage.
Yeah, we are.
Well, real quick, Dr. Lee, I was reading an article just over the weekend that basically said the rating agencies are irrelevant, given all the CDOs, the 2006 generation CDOs, and how wrong every rating was. People are saying, we don't care, we don't need them anymore. Do you believe that the rating agencies are irrelevant?
I don't think they're irrelevant, but I think that one of the missed opportunities in Dodd-Frank was, you know, serious look at rating agencies and the kind of business model they have. And so we address that, I think rating agencies are going to be not nearly as influential, but you look around in terms of what happens in pretty much all the debt markets, and they're still, I think, very relevant, but we're, particularly from a regulatory perspective, putting less importance on them. But I do think they need to be a subject of further reform efforts.
Thank you.
Well, I can't wait to get you back on to talk more about this. We're just really just cracking the lid on this discussion. And Dr. Lee, I just every time we sit down at one of these conferences, you, Jack Guttentag, and I get together, and we usually have several other people join in on it. I would love to just televise or send out on a radio program a whole segment of our conversation because, folks, it is just fascinating the amount of information and the information and foresight that Michael has, Michael Lee, who also he's worked at Wharton International Housing Finance Program there in the University of Pennsylvania with Jack Guttentag. He's a PhD. Great amount of knowledge. Michael, thank you so much for carving out a few minutes of your busy day to be with us here. I look forward to having you back very soon.
Well, great. It's always a pleasure, and thank you very much for having me on your show.
We'll look forward to having you back soon. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care.
You bet. You bet. Thank you. As we do each and every week, we bring you a technology update, and we're going to have Tony Garitano again come on and talk to us a little bit of what's going on in the world of technology. As Andy said earlier, technology is going to be a bigger part and needs to be a bigger part of the future. Tony Garitano, good to have you with us. We've got a few minutes left. Did you have a good 4th of July, by the way?
I did, Dave. I had a great 4th of July. I spent it with the family watching fireworks and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
And you know, it's interesting how technology is even playing into fireworks now, how they launch them technology-wise. But give us an update of what's going on in the fireworks. I mean the technology of our mortgage industry.
Well, I think everyone's talking about loan quality, but if you talk to any lender, they're not going to tell you that they don't produce quality loans. So I think that we have to define what we mean by loan quality so that we can get lenders to understand the term and use technology to get more loan quality through their pipeline. And what I think
means is... Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think it means?
Well, in my grand definition, Dave, loan quality means... Loan quality means that you have a process that is consistent in that you're doing the same things over and over again. It's repeatable in that you have a clear A, B, C, D, E, F, G way to process a loan. And more importantly, that it's visible, meaning that you can track everything that you do and that you have a report indicating exactly what you did, not just so that it's visible to you, but it's visible to investors and regulators.
I know this is Tony Garitano's voice, but I swear to God, you're reading the prophet doctor's signature right here because you're preaching, you're singing from his hymnal there. I mean, that's exactly what he says over and over, just consistency, consistency. So do you see any products out there or any technology tools that are going that direction, really helping, enabling them?
I think a lot of the loan origination systems are moving in that direction, Dave. And as Andy said earlier in your program, you need to find a system that goes from end to end that replicates your process in a clear and consistent way. And I think the way to do that is to get a system that has a really clear and defined business rules engine that you can tweak yourself. And I think what we're seeing is more systems are getting there.
You're saying a key is to be able to tweak the rules in there and be able to go in and do it. Does that require a programmer to be able to go do it, or are these getting to be the point where someone in senior management team can do this and define it fairly easily?
It is getting to a point where you or I can do it, Dave. I'm telling you, I think that technology is becoming so open-ended, so easy to use, and these are questions that you need to ask your LOS and that you need to ask your core systems because you want a business rules engine that you yourself can configure.
That is such a good point. That's excellent. So you are seeing development where we don't need a programmer in order to define those rules, and it can be done on the fly and fairly quickly, Tony?
More and more.
More and more. That's good. Well, so good to have you be with us each and every week as you are. And, folks, if you want to learn more about what Tony has to say, where can they go? Is it www.progressinlending.com? Is that correct, Tony?
Yes, Dave. Thank you.
And we appreciate it. We appreciate you being with us each and every week, and I appreciate the opportunity to write. I got to get an article off to you by the end of the week, and I will, talking about what's going on. Again, you can go over to www.progressinlending. Progressinlending?
Yep, progressinlending.com.
Very good. Tony, thank you so much for being with us each and every week. Let's go back to our regular guests, Alice, Joe, and Andy. Thank you so much for being a part of the program each and every week. Alice, any parting comments for our listeners as we get ready to head into the rest of this hot summer? Probably not so hot up there in Michigan.
Well, just be ready with the new disclosures that are required by the July 21st. You've got to make sure that you have your new adverse action notice correct, just that you're using the new version under ECOA and FACTA combined, and that you have your risk-based pricing disclosures modified under the new rules for applications July 21st.
July 21st on that one. Circle that date on your calendar. Our calendars are circled with so much stuff that's coming down the line. I've got circles. Just circle the whole darn calendar. Something's happening. And then listen to Alice's topic here on Lincoln and Lending to be able to know what you got to do. Thank you so much for being a part of it. Any change on rates real quickly, Joe? Anything changed there?
Well, prices have improved a little bit so far this morning. We're now up. We were just up 12. Now we're up 11. So pretty much holding steady this morning.
Well, it's good to have you be with us. We appreciate an update. Appreciate you. Prophet Doctor, any closing remarks, words of wisdom?
Yeah. Well, people are talking about the concern over going to the private mortgage versus the government. A government Fannie Mae 30-year versus a private 10-year, the price savings in rate is probably a point and a half, and we apply a risk premium into that, we're still going to end up with a lower cost mortgage by going with that 10-year than we are at a government 30-year. So this isn't as bad as it sounds. I don't think it's going to hurt housing. And how many people stay in a house longer than 10 years anyway?
That's right. Great point. Well, maybe they will be staying a little bit longer now that the market's changing a bit. But, you know, good point. Historically, they haven't. Folks, we appreciate you being with us each and every week. Tune in again to this channel, your computer, Blog Talk Radio. Good to have you with us. Have a great good week, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
This has been Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lincoln of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.